Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, let's see. The bond market, Basel III agreements, and black hat hackers. No, I promise. It's going to be a good show. You ought to stick around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 2nd of July. And we begin today with an only somewhat rhetorical question. Why is it that Ben Bernanke gets all the love? The guy has a press conference, the stock market goes bananas, all because the chairman of the Fed said a thing or two that maybe some big investors weren't expecting. I don't know. I'd offer that way down in the weedy cubicles of the Federal Reserve building is where the real heavy lifting is being done, the kind that comes with warnings about too big to fail and systemic risk. I speak here of banking regulations, of course, specifically those under an international agreement known as Basel III. And yes, I know, deadly dull. I apologize. But here's why they matter. Today, the Fed approved new rules about how much capital, how much money the eight biggest banks in this country have to hold on to safely manage their risk, which, if you'll think back with me, gets us back to that bit about too big to fail and, oh yeah, the past 5 years in the global economy. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to get us going.
Think of the economy as a house. Hopefully well-kept, strong foundation, good timbers and bricks. But what if it's poorly maintained, rickety, run down? And a storm hits, really huge. That's what happened to banks in the financial crisis, explains Karen Shaw Petru. She's an analyst at Federal Financial Analytics.
Banks had thin capital cushions,
meaning not enough money on hand to cover losses.
When markets went upside down, they blew up. They couldn't sustain even overnight stress because they had no resources to hang on.
Capital cushions or requirements, that's what Basel III is about, forcing banks to hold more capital against catastrophic losses. Stronger foundations, says Petru.
To give the banks the resources to weather a storm when the next crisis hits.
Making the banks hold more capital puts more of the risk onto the banks themselves and their shareholders. Tom Deutsch is at the American Securitization Forum, which represents lenders and investors. He says there's a danger in too much bank regulation.
To try to eliminate risk in banking is to effectively say that no loan should be made because inherently in a loan is some kind of risk.
And as we've seen since the financial crisis, bankers still like to take plenty of risks. It's possible no amount of capital held in reserve will be enough to keep banks standing in the next financial storm or protect taxpayers from the bank collapses that would follow. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Speaking of risk, you're going to love this next one. Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss got famous thanks to Facebook and the legal fight they had with Mark Zuckerberg over who really came up with the idea for that company. The Winklevi, as they are often called, settled with Zuckerberg for a reported $65 million, part of which the twins have put into Bitcoin, the much-hyped and sometimes troubled digital currency. Now they want to take Bitcoin mainstream. They're launching a fund where you can buy and sell Bitcoins just like a stock. Shrewd, do you suppose? Or stupid? Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more.
If you think investing in a quasi-currency backed by nothing and understood by few is a nutty idea, you're not alone.
Stay away. You've got a better chance of holding onto your money by going to a casino than you do by investing in Bitcoin.
Now, Georgetown finance professor Jim Angel is a Bitcoin skeptic, but even the twins warn potential investors to strap in for a wild ride. In the Winklevoss's SEC filing, the risk section sprawls out over 18 pages. They explain the digital currency could be hacked and it might actually be illegal. So it's not for your retirement fund, but their venture could appeal to pro investors, even Bitcoin foes.
For the many, many folks who are very, very skeptical about the future of Bitcoin, it'll give them a chance to bet against this.
That's Max Wolf, senior analyst at Greencrest. Right now, buying Bitcoins is complicated. Only the most dedicated and passionate bother. The Winklevoss venture would make it as easy as trading GE. Bitcoin is just part of the twins' diverse post-Facebook life. They've invested in the shopping tool Huckster and SumZero, a site connecting money managers. Senior VP Nicholas Kapoor says the duo is hands-on.
A lot of startups get capital. Not a lot are fortunate enough to get very, very involved investors, and that's where we go with Tyler and Cameron.
Kapoor says they're not clones, but definitely a tight team.
Certainly they're a unified front. Generally, when you get one, you get both.
And together, they're doubling down on Bitcoin. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
From the Winklevi now to some more famous names, Duke Ellington, Vladimir Horowitz, Cole Porter, Sergei Rachmaninoff, and Billy Joel, all piano players of some renown, all of whom played, or play in Mr. Joel's case, Steinways. The legendary company behind many a parent's dream of their kid making it to Carnegie Hall is changing hands. The piano maker is selling itself to a private equity firm for about $500 million, as Marketplace's Sally Herships tells us.
To understand why Steinway is selling for hundreds of millions of dollars, let's take a trip to Queens through the wonder of film.
You know, when I first visited the factory, I was so fascinated with what I was seeing.
Ben Niles is the director of Note by Note, a documentary that follows the making of a Steinway grand piano. The process can take up to a year.
People were just working away like they were in Geppetto's workshop.
Building the pianos, mostly by hand, which gives each one a unique sound.
Does this make them like the Rolls Royce of piano makers?
You're right. It is absolutely the very high end.
Ernie Erstner is managing director of CJS Securities. He says a Steinway Grand can sell for well over $100,000, and there are two types of buyers, both of whom can be counted on in good times and bad. First, the very rich.
He may have a private plane. He may have an estate. If he has an estate, he may very well have or desire to have a Steinway piano in his home.
Then there are the professional musicians. Erstner says the company sells 2,500 pianos globally a year, and it's looking to expand, especially into places like China. So kids, take heart. A shot at Carnegie Hall is only 10,000 hours of practice away. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Everything was groovy on Wall Street till about lunchtime, then traders ran out of gas. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There's a day left, plus or minus, until the Egyptian army says it's going to do something to stop the protests in that country. Protests that have turned violent today, and as more people go to the streets, protests that are increasingly keeping businesses and their customers apart. Kimberly Adams is a journalist living in Cairo. Kimberly, it's good to talk to you.
Nice to speak with you as well.
This protest started on Sunday, which we should point out is a work day in Cairo, which means now that it's been three business days that parts of that city have effectively been shut down.
Yeah, that's correct. And even in the parts of the city that aren't directly feeling the protest, there are still definite effects on businesses. I'm standing right now in a neighborhood in Cairo called Manyal, which this time of night is usually very busy with people walking up and down the street and frequenting the businesses on the street. And right now, those businesses are shuttered. People are worried about possible roving gangs or the protests going badly. And also, they are worried that no customers are going to come because people might be out in the protests.
So if you wanted to get, a loaf of bread and a cup of coffee now, could you do that?
Yeah, you can get a loaf of bread and a cup of coffee, but you can't really go and have a major appointment at the bank. You can't go to an embassy. And maybe if you want to go shopping for clothes at your local neighborhood shop, you're not going to be able to do that. It's kind of those in-between shops from the basic necessities as opposed to the major corporations that are shutting down. Maybe because the people are either in the streets or they're worried about the security.
Yeah, it sounds busy, right?
The traffic is always busy
in Cairo,
but it's the pedestrian traffic that's down.
Or is there an industry around these protests? I mean, protesters have to eat, they have to drink, they have to, you know, I don't know, have a place for shelter. Are people selling tents and you know, bread and stuff?
I haven't seen people selling tents, but they're selling just about everything else. So, for example, on the first day of the protest, I was embedded with some doctors who were manning a field hospital, and two of them tried to go out and get some koshery, which is this traditional Egyptian pasta dish, yeah. And they went out very early in the protest, and the koshery was sold out. But there were still people selling corn on the cobs and all sorts of other things, lots of bottles of water, and, of course, those ubiquitous V for Vendetta masks that people like to wear at protests.
Yeah, which is, by the way, owned by Time Warner, so they make money every time those masks are sold, but that's a whole different story we're going to do.
Yeah, assuming they're not counterfeit.
Yeah, that's right. We were talking to a guy yesterday who runs a tourist gift shop in one of the big bazaars there, and he said something to me that just amazed me. He was eager for and ready for the military to take over, for them to get rid of Morsi, and for the army to be back in charge. Can you maybe help me understand why people might feel like that?
Because of the instability. I mean, people here are protest weary. Yes, there are hundreds of thousands of people willing to go out in the streets and protest, but a lot of people are just tired of it. They're tired of their food prices going up, they're tired of waiting in long lines for gasoline, and they're tired of not knowing what's coming the next day. I mean, that's one of the reasons why all these businesses are shut down. People are worried that these protests are going to go badly and that there are going to be like roaming groups of thugs coming through the neighborhood busting up windows.
Kimberly Adams in a very noisy Cairo, as it always is. Kimberly, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Dunkin' Donuts ain't just donuts anymore, you know.
Quite honestly, if I were sitting in Seattle looking out on, you know, Puget Sound in the Starbucks headquarters, I'd be saying, oh boy, they'd be a little scared perhaps.
Yeah, maybe. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street tried to draft off the Motor City's success today and failed. The Dow Industrials skidded 42 points, about 0.3%. Closed at 14,932. The blue chips did. The Nasdaq idled down a single point, basically flat. Finished at 34.33. Ditto for the S&P 500. Ended the day at 16.14, which, if memory serves, was where it ended yesterday. General Motors and Ford both reported stronger than expected sales today, especially in pickup trucks, for what that's worth. Ford reached a higher gear, up 2.8%. GM shares revved up 0.3% today. All right, so here's a bad segue. Don't do this. From driving to drinking, alcohol conglomerate Constellation Brands disappointed investors. The company blamed high grape prices for slow wine sales. Constellation stock swallowed 3.5% today. Bond prices didn't budge, about which more later, by the way. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The thermostat is rising. We enter the dog days of summer. Need some heavy metal to go with that? If you're in Guilford, New Hampshire, you can start banging your head tomorrow when Megadeth's Gigantour opens. And on July 3rd, 1890, Idaho was admitted to the Union. You might be wondering, can you cook an Idaho potato in the microwave? Yes. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talk pretty much every day on this program about the stock market because, honestly, that's the thing most people pay attention to. We talk not quite so much about bonds because even though the debt market is way bigger than equities, it's also way more complicated. If you've been watching lately, bond prices have been getting whacked, hit really hard on the downside. So bond yields, the interest they pay, has been jumping higher. We asked Marketplace's Adrienne Hill to explain why that happens.
Okay, pack fast. We're going back to college.
Dartmouth
specifically. But we don't have time for fight songs and beer. Not right now. We've got a Bonds 101 class to get to, taught by economics professor Charlie Whelan.
So let's get started with class. Adrienne, is the reason that you were late today?
Kai had a question about the homework. I'm so sorry.
Okay, well, you're here now. So let's talk about bonds. A bond is essentially a loan where I'm going to give you some money and you are going to give it back to me at some point in the future. I'm not going to loan you the money out of the goodness of my heart. You're actually going to pay a rental rate on the money that I'm giving it to you. That's the best way to think about it. And that rental rate is going to be some rate of interest.
So, Professor Whelan, here's just what I don't get. I mean, why the inverse relationship between interest rates and bond prices? Higher interest rates should be good for bonds, right? I mean, they're going to pay out more money.
No, because when interest rates go up, the bonds that paid the old lower interest rate are now worth less. So that's the way to think about it. Somebody's got a newer, shinier bond. And what newer, shinier means in the bond market is it pays a higher interest rate. So you got the old bond that pays 3%. The new bond at roughly the same price, $1,000, pays 4%. So the only way that you're going to be able to unload your old, less shiny bond is to lower the price of it.
I think I got it. And we're talking about this now because we think Fed policy is going to push interest rates up, which could push down bond prices, right?
Exactly. The only thing I would add is that the interest rates have already started going up. So we've already seen that movement a little bit, but we expect it might become even more significant.
Which means lower prices for anyone invested in bonds. It's all starting to get clear.
Thank you. You have a good fourth. I will see you next week.
It was 113 degrees Fahrenheit on the Strip in Las Vegas today. That's actually down a couple of degrees from this weekend. Temperatures have been much the same over large parts of the southwest United States for days now, which means the man I'm about to talk to has been busy indeed. Joe Johnson runs and owns Rebel Refrigeration and Air Conditioning in Las Vegas, Nevada. Mr. Johnson, how you doing?
Very good. Thank you.
So this heat wave must be like money in the bank for you, huh?
Well, yeah, one would think. And it's definitely time and we're earning a lot of business. But it's also a spooky time because if we don't get out to our existing clientele quick enough, they won't call us the rest of the year. You know, so it's an urgent time. But yeah, we're definitely making a couple extra bucks.
People must be so glad to see you when you come.
It's like the doctor. They're happy to see us because they know they're going to get some cooled air, but they always, you know, they don't like the bill, that's for sure.
Well, how much is it going to cost me if my air conditioner breaks and you come to see me?
It can be something so simple, Kai, as something that it was just a switch turned off, we probably wouldn't even charge. And of course, then unfortunately, there's those with those older units that it's best to replace the whole thing. You know, it could be anywhere from $5,000 to $7,000.
No, come on, really?
Yeah, yeah.
How do you know when it's over? I mean, does it ever end in Las Vegas, or do you just keep on going?
Well, it's funny. For us in our trade, what happens is because of this heat wave, this causes all the breakdowns.
Yeah.
And over the next few weeks, we'll tend to get the bulk of them repaired and anything that wasn't running right. And while the temperatures will still remain up there, at least, you know, everybody's air conditioner is fixed. So, but about, you know, every year about the first week of September, the heat breaks, and gosh, for us AC guys, it feels like we can breathe again.
Let me ask you this. What do you do to stay out of the heat? You must have some big nuclear-powered unit at your house that just chills it way down.
I definitely keep my units cooler, and, you know, everybody likes to be outdoors during the summer, but I tell you, Kai, for me, when I'm off, I do not go outdoors, and I have a pool, and I probably swim in it like once or twice a year. I don't even go outside.
Smart man. Yeah. Joe Johnson, he owns Rebel Refrigeration and Air Conditioning out in Las Vegas, Nevada. Joe, thanks a bunch. I'll let you get back to work.
You bet, sir. Thank you.
One need look no further than Edward Snowden to appreciate cybersecurity and its role in the world today. No, Mr. Snowden isn't a hacker, nor is the data he revealed the fruit of hacking. But as we all increasingly live our lives digitally, so we become increasingly vulnerable. Black hats is what hackers with malicious intent are called, as distinguished from white hats, the good guys. But there's a growing middle ground out there, gray hats, if you will, where hackers can get into trouble doing what computer geeks have always done. Hence, the cybersecurity boot camp, where students learn how to hack for good and at the same time keep their career opportunities open. Marketplace's Queen of Kim paid him a visit.
The boot camp is in the ESET building in San Diego. And right now, we're in the war room.
How?
ESET is an IT security company based in Slovakia. It's putting on the camp for Westview High's cybersecurity team. Vinil Adusamili just graduated and he's headed to MIT.
There are 9 computers in here, then there's another giant tower here called the Sinister Purveyor of Doom, which we're supposed to hack as part of our training.
The Sinister Purveyor of Doom mimics a company's server, and the high school students get points for cracking passwords, accessing files, and for causing mayhem, like launching an attack that locks out users.
Again, you have to get inside the mind of the hacker.
Cameron Camp is a security researcher at ESET, and he's defending the Sinister Purveyor of Doom. His job isn't to teach the kids how to hack into systems. They're already pretty good at that. Instead, Camp is here to teach them how to hack ethically.
You've got 2 ways you can go. You can go work for the good guys, good pay, travel to interesting countries, never have to look over your shoulder. You go to the dark side, you're going to go to jail.
The word hackers becomes shorthand for cyber criminals. But hacker used to describe people who found clever, creative, and often unconventional ways to create things. Black hat hackers deface websites, steal credit card numbers, or corporate secrets. And then the white hats, they use their power for good. Camp focuses on the gray middle ground that lots of hackers wander into.
It's the people say that I can't do this, so I'm going to show them that nothing is impenetrable.
Griffin Stamp is going to be a junior at Westview High. And he's sitting across from Dennis Alenikoff, who just graduated and is headed to San Francisco to work at a startup. Dennis is looking into a program called Cookie Hijacker.
It scans the air for anyone accessing Facebook, Gmail, whatnot, gives you the login credentials, you can log in as them. Done.
So then you can just sign in as me?
Yep.
You look at Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who started Apple, and they made equipment to bypass charges on telephones.
Stephen Cobb is ESET's security evangelist. He says testing the limits and breaking things is engineering 101. To build systems, you also need to know how to take them apart. But these days, the stakes are getting a lot higher.
Nowadays, every aspect of our lives comes into contact with computers.
And activities that were once tolerated are now crimes.
A lot of the early hacking was breaking into university systems. These were young people exploring the technology and learning by exploring.
He says universities traditionally look the other way, but in recent years, the federal government hasn't. As a result, unsuspecting techies are getting caught up in the dragnet. Law enforcement officials have gone after hackers who publicly disclose flaws in computer networks and internet activists who hack to promote the free flow of information.
Something will have to be done eventually to distinguish between exploratory type of activity that are on the gray side of ethical behavior.
Gordon Romney teaches at National University in San Diego. He spoke at the boot camp. Romney says IT security firms often rely on government contracts, which require security clearances.
That creates a real dilemma for us because some of the best minds in this field are those individuals who, sometimes not knowing what they were doing or just for the thrill of it, pursued things that led them to being caught.
And makes it almost impossible to get a security clearance and a job.
Okay, here. I will not injure others, their property, reputation.
Back at the boot camp, Romney goes over the hacker code of ethics with the group.
I'll not use access to information for personal gains through corporate espionage.
Are you getting the picture of what ethics is all about?
So far, the high school students seem to get it. Not too long ago, they figured out how to access everybody's grade from the school's website. But instead of making the grades public, they informed some very grateful school district officials. Now that's a white hat. In San Diego, I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
Just because there aren't enough places to spend $2.50 or more on a cup of coffee in this country, now comes Dunkin' Donuts, which is apparently not satisfied with crullers and glazed old fashions anymore. They're moving upmarket, as it were, going after the leader in the caffeine field. Nancy Kane from the Harvard Business School is here to make us smart on this. Hey, Nancy, good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure, Kai.
So Dunkin' Donuts is redesigning its stores to look more like Starbucks, yes?
Yes, that's what they tell us.
But here's the thing. We've already got a Starbucks. Hello?
We sure do. So what in the heck is going on?
Right.
And
Right.
And it's made more interesting by the fact that for some years now, you know, Dunkin' Donuts has gone to town on a set of commercials and billboards and advertisements attacking Starbucks.
I know.
Get on their website and buy a T-shirt that says, "Friends, don't let friends drink Starbucks." You know, you can see the television commercial where the customer struggles to, like, make out Italian words, you know, making fun of Starbucks language. I mean, it's really interesting. And now, suddenly, they want to be more like Starbucks.
It does bear a mention, though, that a lot of Dunkin' Donuts stores are shabby is too strong, but downscale might not be too rough.
You know, they are a little grotty, as we say in England, a nation now increasingly of coffee drinkers. But you know, Dunkin' Donuts is learning a lot from Starbucks, including the idea that specialty coffee experience is like retailing. You better keep the merchandise and the surroundings fresh. So yeah. I think that's a piece of it. But I think there's something else going on. Like, you know, I think they're realizing that Starbucks and lots of mom and pop coffee shops have really changed the game of selling a cup of Joe.
It's always when I go to Dunkin' Donuts, it's always to go, man. I grab a cup of coffee and I'm out of there.
You grab your coffee and you you go. And the interesting thing is America runs on Dunkin', right? They've made their name on being, you know, a cup of Joe quickly to go. So now this is a big turnabout. And so I think it's very, very interesting. I mean, quite honestly, if I were sitting in Seattle looking out on, you know, Puget Sound in the Starbucks headquarters, I'd be saying, oh, boy, they'd be a little scared perhaps.
Would you really?
A little bit, because again, this has been really two very different companies. And one of them, Dunkin' Donuts, has used advertising very, very aggressively to fire a lot of salvos over the bow of Starbucks. But now suddenly everything that Starbucks represents and the whole brand, you know, if you will, promise, now Dunkin' Donuts wants a healthy piece of that.
No joke, right? All right, so put up or shut up. Where do you go, Dunkin' or Starbucks?
So I'm too over-caffeinated by nature to drink a lot of caffeinated coffee. So when I'm in a Starbucks store, it's a grande coffee of the day, dark roast, decaf. Yeah. The world is better for that.
There you go. Nancy Kahn at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks a bunch.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Marketplace any way you'd like every day, right here on your local public radio station and on marketplace.org, Slacker, Swell, Stitcher, TuneIn, and iTunes. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, appropriate, I think, as Independence Day approaches. Brand Keys, a New York-based research firm, is out with a list of the most patriotic American brands. Number one in the survey, the most iconic of American automobiles, Jeep, owned, it must be said, by that most Italian of car companies, Fiat. Number 14, just in time for the July 4th barbecue, Budweiser, a flagship offering of the Belgian-Brazilian conglomerate Anheuser-Busch InBev. You can check the list for yourself. We've got it at marketplace.org. And with that, we are done. That's Marketplace, owned by American Public Media. Today, the Dow off 42 points, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ down just a single point, basically flat. The S&P 500 off a point as well, also basically flat. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Bye. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.